Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
Welcome back, Taxation is Theft. And I have with me today Max Abramson, who is sitting in the New Hampshire state representative seat. He is currently elected, he is currently serving, and we're gonna have an awesome talk today. Before we jump in, make sure you like, subscribe, comment, and share this with all of your friends. Feel free to ask questions at any time during the video if you're watching live, and if you're listening to the podcast, which you can get on iTunes and everywhere else that you get podcasts, go ahead and share this with your friends, and go check out the Taxation is Theft merch store also at taxationistheft.cards. Max, welcome. How's it going?
Lousy.
Why is that?
You have to pay some taxes. People today always say fine, but they're not really. They're always kind of, you know, it's raining out and their faces wet and there's water running down their back and they've been out working all day and they're tired, and I say, oh, I'm fine. Are they really?
Yeah. Well, cheers to that. I'm drinking my coffee right now because I've had an exhausting day working, I am actually burnt out myself. So, but if you would have asked me without that, I would have said, yeah, I'm doing fine. Man. So, so how's it going? You're actually an elected libertarian. How's that working
right
out?
Well, it's my second term. In both cases, because of New Hampshire's strange ballot access laws and the way the whole process works and losing, we only briefly had major party status because of my 2016 gubernatorial campaign. And I knew that we were going to lose that in 2018. I think that was pretty expected. In New Hampshire, you have a really high threshold for getting on the ballot. It's 1,500 valid signatures for each congressional district, which is 3,000. But because so many get thrown away for any detail or they get lost in the system, we have to get just over 6,000 altogether to be sure that we get on the ballot. And then to stay on the ballot, we have to get over 4% of the vote in any statewide race. And the problem with that is we haven't done that in 20 years. It was my gubernatorial campaign that broke national records and finally broke through that threshold. And so for 2 years, we were able to go in and actually register as a libertarian. And I discovered, as a voter, I discovered that I was the only registered libertarian in my entire town, which was a little disappointing. But there were over about 1,100 total in the whole state at one point.
Wow. So so in New Hampshire, when you register to vote, you register your party affiliation at the time you register?
Yeah, you register Republican, Democrat, or undeclared. And if you try to go in and put your party affiliation as Green or Libertarian or something else, they'll just call you undeclared. And I don't think your registration even gets counted anymore with the Secretary of State's office. A little bit of a Debbie Downer.
Interesting. But you're still registered. You're still able to vote at that point.
I can still vote. Technically, my affiliation on my legislative page is libertarian, and I keep the word libertarian on there, member of the Libertarian Party since the year 2000. In fact, if you go to my bio right down at the bottom of miscellaneous, it says member of the Libertarian Party since 2000. Actually, I've been a small L libertarian since I was a kid. Nice. My journey started with a strange question that my older brother asked about, property. Property rights. He asked the famous question, do you have the right to put minefields on your own property? And actually, that turns out to be a really complicated question. There's a lot to it, and especially for a small kid, and I was just watching my first World War II movies, it was interesting because it kind of delves into all the different aspects of civil law, criminal law, property rights, and the rest of it. And that's kind of how I got my start becoming philosophically libertarian.
Wow. So is there any conflict in that? Because like I like, for example, in Texas, they have like an affiliation rule where if you show up to, whenever you show up to any convention, like any primary convention, any political party convention, you basically you have to sign on your voter. I think it's on your voter registration card that you're affiliated now with a particular party, and they stamp it. And you're that basically prevents you from participating in any other party in any other way. So is there any kind of like conflict there where you're kind of like half in the Libertarian Party and half in the Republican Party?
No, I think that everyone at the State House knows me as that Libertarian guy. We actually have a number of, I call them conservatarians, that they're half conservative, half Libertarian, probably good 50 or 60 in the State House who run as Republicans. They're probably about as much Republican as Libertarian, but they are, you know, you look at their NHLA scores, New Hampshire Liberty Alliance, and you'll see that there's about a good 50 or 60 who are at about 90% and above voting to protect your rights 90% of the time or more. Awesome. And I had 99% my first year, and I had 91% the second year. And I thought, there must be something wrong, because I always vote pretty much the same way, less government. And I went and checked out I think it was 3 or 4 votes where they said that I'd gotten it wrong. And it was really, really minor things like, should veterans be allowed to put a veterans memorial at their own expense on school grounds? And I voted to allow that. I didn't think that the school district should be allowed to prevent that. And strangely, New Hampshire Liberty Alliance seemed to take the wrong position on that. But they're a pretty good group. We came up with the idea for that on a napkin. I think I was the one who, I should have kept the napkin. 2003 or 2004, I wrote the idea down on a napkin and shared it with other people, and how you would rate legislators and how you would weight different grades. And now we grade all of our legislators, and the Democrats range from a pretty predictable 13, maybe 10% to about, I think the highest is about 40 or 41%. Occasionally we would have one who'd get 47%. And the rest are, the Republicans range from about 40% to 100%. So we do have a, like I say, a number of Liberty Republicans up there in the State House who really consistently, you know, take the floor, speak in defense of your constitutional rights, and, you know, vote for less government any chance that they get. There's not that much you can do as a state rep, although I do introduce bills now and then, ballot access bills. Mm-hmm. I put in an amendment to a marijuana tax bill and replaced it with basically a decrim bill. We still don't have full decriminalization. We kind of have decriminalization and medical marijuana in New Hampshire, but we're the only state that hasn't legalized marijuana. So a compromise bill was sent through called House Bill 481, and that passed overwhelmingly, but it doesn't have enough votes to overcome the governor's veto. But that's neither here nor there, because the president of the Senate basically took the bill and is just holding on to it for a year and preventing it from getting a vote.
Yeah, we saw the same kind of shenanigan in Texas when we passed the, who was it? I think it was the name Simpson. I don't remember if it was, I can't recall his first name, but he had basically a bill that would strike anything from state law that had anything to do with cannabis or hemp. And it passed through the committee, and then it just sat in the House, calendaring committee, and so they just never voted on it. That's really a shame. Like it, when there's that that, what's that cartoon, like how does a bill become a law? They don't teach you about that part.
Did you see the Simpsons parody?
A long time ago.
Who left all this garbage on the steps of Congress? That I was watching that again after serving a full term, my first full term as a legislator. And I almost cried, because it's true that it literally, bills do go through that way. There's a study by Princeton University scholars, and they found in Congress that whether the public supports something or not, it's got a 30% chance of passage. But if the lobbyists don't want it, it has zero chance of passing. But if they do want it, then it's got a 60% chance of passing. So they basically decide what becomes law, and we have absolutely no say because we're trapped in a two-party system where there, you know, other countries have kind of a centrist, center-right, center-left party that at least responds to what the public says. The only way that centrist parties can kind of get in there in a first-past-the-post system like Britain or Canada is by being more responsive to what the public wants than the other two parties. And I've noticed the other two parties, especially in our state legislatures, really kind of gotten lockjaw. They've kind of become stuck in their ways. The Republicans, my Republican colleagues pretty much just vote no on absolutely everything. And the even if it's the occasional pro-liberty bill, they still tend to vote no. So like legalization of marijuana, there are only maybe a third of Republicans voted with that. But they tend to just vote no on everything. They're not libertarians. They really are kind of what Teddy Roosevelt described as ultra-conservative. And then the Democrats totally disregard the public also, and they take, if they can find polling data where the public wants something, they'll hide another state income tax behind that, they'll hide another state sales tax behind something else. You know, it's always more taxes, more spending, more lawsuits, more regulations, more regulatory fines, more overpriced boondoggle projects, every way they can get their hands into your pocket. So neither of the two major parties really seems to be looking out for the best interests of the public. But it's really noticeable that neither of the two parties are responding to what the public says, even if you got 80 or 90% support for something. The Democrats use the same strategy on their end, which is, you know, take the polling data and use it to justify pushing more of their kind of George Soros, Michael Bloomberg, Tom Steyer agenda through. And the Republicans just say no on everything, and there's almost never a Republican alternative.
Interesting. Yeah, it's there's a cartoon going around that's like, yeah, I think we should have like absolute freedom. Everyone should have more freedom. Oh, you mean like cannabis should be unregulated? And whoa, no, not that much freedom.
It's funny, people sometimes describe libertarians as conservative, and we're the ones who are consistently for less government, more freedom all the time. And our conservative friends are for a little bit less government and a little bit more freedom, but only, you know, so much. And when we keep asking, hey, why aren't you defending freedom, and even when the liberals want something, occasionally the liberals will favor less government. They usually tend to oppose things like the Patriot Act, the NDAA. They're usually with us opposing SOPA, PIPA, FISA, government surveillance. You know, most liberals are opposed to the foreign military aggression. It's just the two parties in Congress that seem to endorse every single foreign military adventure. And you know, what was the vote on the Patriot Act? 99-1. Paul Wellstone was the only good guy on the whole, you know, floor of the Senate to vote against that. And he dies in a plane crash shortly thereafter. So we ended up losing the one civil libertarian in the entire Senate.
Wow. Yeah, it's also really interesting to see that, you know, talking to so many people, what the Democrat, like, you can almost draw a line between Democrat voters and Democrat politicians as far as what they want. It's almost like the politicians are, you know, they kind of know that like what they're selling is a little bit different than what they're actually doing. And I would argue, like, you know, some of the Republicans are kind of the same. There's, you know, what they're selling is like, hey, this is what you're going to get. But what we're going to do is like, yeah, we're going to sneak some taxes in there. We're going to have, you know, we're going to go to war. We're going to do all this. So I think that's really interesting to see, because, you know, talking to a lot of people, you talk to the voters a lot, and they're like, they're generally good people. They're not interested in ripping people off or taking other people's freedoms away. Of course, there are, you know, extremists in every group, but a lot of people are actually more centered than the politicians that represent them in their parties, I think.
It's funny, when you look at European politics, they always have a legitimate liberal party. Like liberal in the European sense, almost like a classical liberal or a social liberal. And they're more in line with our thinking. And they always end up as the party in the center. Now you have some center-right liberal parties like the FDP in Germany or Switzerland, and then you have center-left liberal parties like the Liberal Party in Britain or Canada. And, I mean, there's no question where they are on the political spectrum, but when it comes down to, I don't know if you remember that little chart that they showed where it has Hillary Clinton and it's all red X's all the way down, mm-hmm. and then it's Bernie Sanders and it's all green check marks all the way down. Well, Bernie Sanders was on the libertarian side on almost every social and foreign policy issue. And I thought, wow, if, you know, I'd much rather have him than Hillary or most of these establishment Democrats or establishment Republicans, at least as far as being in the White House, choking off the worst, you know, elements of the two parties by vetoing bills. I think that if Bernie Sanders had gotten the nomination, he probably would have been elected and he'd probably be spending his entire time with the Republican congresses and just really? Just veto everything and cancel everything out. Whereas I think if you'd had Hillary Clinton as president, things would have been much worse.
Yeah, things would have been ugly. But that's interesting that you say that, because, you know, I mean, he always talks about raising the income tax to 70%, but of course he would need Congress to pass a bill.
52 or 54%
to pay for. I've heard different numbers. I've heard in one interview he said, "Yeah, the income tax used to be as high as 90%." Mm-hmm.
Ocasio-Cortez and Congresswoman Omar both promoting 70% tax rates. Right. Thomas Hartman on his show is promoting 91% tax rates again, and it just shows. I think 70% of Americans have said that their taxes are too high, and about half have said that they're way too high. And I've always, all my campaign signs say the same thing, smaller government, local control. I've gone out and campaigned continuously on just getting money, power, and decision-making down to the local level and back to the people. And we'll take care of problems at the local level. And, you know, go back to a constitutionally limited government, drastically reduce the role of the state bureaucracy. And when you're doing things at the local level, I think it's more practical. It isn't just that it costs a lot less, but when you're dealing with people one at a time, if someone has an addiction, drinking addiction, gambling addiction, drug addiction, eating addiction, or if they have emotional problems or learning problems or lack of job skills, you know the person, you know their background, you kind of know what they're capable of doing, and you figure out how to address the problem first and then get them to work, kind of get them back on their feet. Whereas the federal bureaucracy does the same thing as the Soviet Union did. They just take hundreds of thousands of people, run them through the same, you know, concrete buildings and institutions, whether it's prisons or public schools or almost any other governmental institution. They just run massive numbers of people through cold-hearted government bureaucracy, and out they go, and they end up a lot of them end up back out in the street or causing problems for others because they don't get the real help that they need, because they're just kind of being pushed through a big expensive top-down one-size-fits-all system. And everyone is different people need different kinds of help, and I think that we have to really emphasize civil society, not walk away from civil society just because the public sector unions have their people out there yelling and screaming and shouting and protesting. It's all the more reason to talk about local churches, local charities, local towns, local schools, human services agencies, mutual aid societies, lodges, extended family, and all the traditional institutions that we've used since colonial times to actually help people one by one, not running people through a big cold bureaucracy.
Right. Yeah, and it's really kind of alarming to see how many, you know, when you talk about lobbyists who are supporting bills, how many, you know, prison guard unions are out there saying like, oh yeah, we need stricter laws, we need to continue the drug war because, and you know, they say like, oh, it's because the drugs are dangerous, but really, you know, they're talking about their jobs. That's all they care about.
And the Attorney General's office would always send a rep, and the Police Chiefs Association would usually send a rep. Sometimes they just find some rank and file cop and send them in and testify against medical marijuana. And 99% of people support allowing medical use of marijuana. 62% would legalize marijuana outright. That's nationwide. 72% would decriminalize it. And almost no one I talk to actually wants pot smokers just thrown in jail. It doesn't work. It's not really even addictive substance. It may be habit forming, but we don't throw people in jail for coffee or even tobacco.
Right.
I mean, tobacco is more addictive than marijuana is.
And so, and you know, we talk about this all the time. The government's supposed to represent the people. Why is it that such a high percentage of people want you know, whether you know, some form of decriminalization or legalization, and the government's just like, we don't work for you. We're going to do our own thing.
The reason is politicians want to get reelected, and the prosecutors, police chiefs, the corrections unions, the prison industry, they're always up at the state house every single day lobbying for what they want. The left-wing activists are up there. The trial lawyers are up there. You'll see even municipalities have New Hampshire Municipal Association. You've got 424 legislators in my state, and people think that's an outrageous number. Well, you've got more lobbyists than legislators. And in other states, you've got thousands. In Washington, D.C., what are they up over 100,000 lobbyists now? 30,000 lobbying for more tax money, 40,000 lobbying for special tax breaks, and then tens of thousands lobbying for other legal changes and
wow.
And blocking competition in the marketplace and claiming that it's for safety. And we hear it all. I mean, we hear it all. They always insist that they have to use the state to block competition. And they use politicians to do it because politicians usually don't care what happens to the folks back home.
Right. That's interesting you bring up the number of legislators, because I think in, where was it? Was it somewhere in the Constitution where it said no representative should represent more than 10,000 people or something like that? Or there was a...
Right. There's a constitutional amendment and it has no deadline. And it's floated around, and state legislatures at one time were rattling the saber and threatening Congress, if you don't do this, that, or the other thing, we'll ratify this to say... You know, that you have to read it three or four times over to realize that it would have no more impact today because the population is so large. So even if it were to pass, yeah, it would go into the Constitution, but we don't really have any leverage against Congress. We would have to start another amendment to limit the power of Congress to interfere with the states. The worst, and Congress would never send that amendment down because they've got so much power right now. There is a solution to that, that again, those minor parties are using, Liberty parties are using in other countries. And the solution that works is pretty simple. They form center right or center left political party, pretty clear spot on the political spectrum. And the argument that they make is we keep things at the political center. We prevent, say, Trump from taking us off into right-wing populism, and we prevent Bernie Sanders and the Democrats from taking us off into left-wing populism or democratic socialism, and just kind of preserve traditional constitutional rights that liberals and conservatives like. The way that it works in first-past-the-post countries is out of 435 House districts in Congress, there are 170 that are entrenched and always go Republican every single year, no matter how you vote, because the Democrats can't beat them there. And there are 170 other House districts that always go Democrat every single year, no matter what, and they're entrenched. Likewise, at the state level, if you look at the 2016 election results, it's been the same since, I don't know, 30-some-odd years. There are 14 safe blue wall states that always go Democrat every single year. That's good for about 240 electoral college votes. But then there are another 20 states, 20 safe Republican states that go Republican every single year. So what these minor parties do is they'll go, let's say you live in a city, and if you were a conservative or Republican or a small business owner or a school choice voter, you know, the Democrats are entrenched. There's nothing you can do. You can't have any impact on the system. So these minor parties will go and compete. And the first thing they do is they take a little door hanger. I don't have one with me. And they'll every single household in the whole city that has even one Republican voter in it, they'll leave a door hanger that says, you know, conservatives aren't winning here or Republicans aren't winning here in this district. So vote Libertarian, because the Libertarian Party or whatever the Liberal Party is the only party that's in real competition with the Democrats here. And likewise, out in rural areas, we're already using tactical voting as a strategy to pick up votes, to pick up seats. And we had, in 2016, we had 28 different legislative races that were well organized and well put together, where the campaigns won more than 25% of the vote. And we had a few that went, you know, well into the 30s, 38, 39%. And we've had statewide races where you get 18%, like Michael Cloud in Massachusetts, or Joe Miller won 29% in Alaska. And those are normally safe Republican districts or safe Democrat districts. And when the member of the out party realizes that they don't have a chance of winning with their own candidate, they vote tactically. And the only thing that we have to do is have a presidential campaign, have a presidential candidate who really understands tactical voting. In Canada, they call it strategic voting. But if you wanted to keep out Harper as the conservative candidate, they organized an effort called strategic voting. If you go to strategicvoting.ca on the web, you'll see how they kind of arrange it. You plug in your district and it says, here's the guy who has the best chance of beating the conservative in that particular riding. And you vote for some areas the Liberals, some areas the Greens, some areas the NDP. It's whoever keeps out Harper. So there's a big chunk of votes that are really, for example, if you live in the 20 safe Republican states and all you want to do is keep out Trump, then the only way to do that is if we organize high-profile statewide campaigns and keep making the case that, hey, in this state, in the Carolinas, in Alaska, in Montana or Arizona, the only way to keep Trump out in this state is to vote Libertarian. And you'll have a lot of Democrat-leaning voters, a lot of liberals and progressives showing up and voting Libertarian to keep Trump out. But also, if we demonstrate our where we agree on social issues and foreign policy issues and some elections issues like independent redistricting commissions, not just for showing up, but showing up and voting straight Libertarian, and that would help get a lot of Libertarians elected down ticket. Remember, you have 435 House seats, but you've got 511,000 elected positions around the country. So there are over 1,000 elected positions per House district. So one really active House campaign, you've got coattails for about 1,000 more candidates down ticket. Right. So figure if we run as a team, you have 1,000 other races. If they're all working and campaigning to get that candidate into office, cost Democrats a seat in some areas and cost the Republican a seat in other areas, then you both boost voter turnout and flip a few seats. It's a lot of work doing it as a minor party, but there are a lot of districts around the country that are totally open to that kind of competition. And a lot of the Libertarians I've talked to at national and state conventions are enthusiastic about that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to ask, because, you mentioned a lot of these other countries where they do have whether a central party or a classic liberal party. Why do you think it is that the United States is just so stuck in this way of having two parties and there's no option for anything in the middle? It's one or the other.
Is people don't realize that the Electoral College is a parliamentary system, parliamentary to elect the president. The House of Representatives is a parliamentary system to elect just the Speaker of the House, who appoints the committee chairs. People don't realize that the Founding Fathers modeled the American system off the British system. In Britain, they have a House of Representatives. Their House of Representatives has a dual role of both legislating and approving new tax increases and spending bills, but they also appoint the prime minister, the head of state. In America, the Founding Fathers didn't like that idea very much, so they did stick with the parliamentary system, but they split it into two separate responsibilities. If you read Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Paper number 68, they intentionally split the House of Commons into two, a House of Representatives to originate tax bills and an Electoral College, which would elect the president. We actually don't vote for presidents. We vote for electors.
Right.
So
you think it's mostly the election system that kind of influences how people make decisions on what they're actually voting for.
Right. So if you can vote for whomever you want for Congress, but it's strange that it's broken up by state in almost all states. That's the unusual thing. So we have to kind of take it state by state. But if you live in New England, New York, Illinois, New Mexico, Colorado, any of the West Coast states, Hawaii, those 14 states always, always go Democrat, meaning that they never go Republican. It doesn't mean that they wouldn't go for a more center or even center right third party. I think as Governor Johnson and Governor Weld picked up, the better messaging was fiscally conservative, but socially tolerant and socially inclusive. So we're cool with everybody. Religious minorities, ethnic minorities, gender minorities, economic minorities. We're concerned about protecting the rights of all individuals, regardless of their background. It's not just that we're more pro-immigration and that we generally support LGBT rights and privacy and civil liberties and non-interventionist foreign policy. There's a lot that we have to offer to younger Democrat-leaning voters, and our kind of European liberal counterparts in other countries generally tend to appeal to younger voters who generally tend to get skipped over. If they show up, they tend to vote Democrat, but they usually don't show up at all. And that's an enormous demographic that we have. Now, if you're living in a city and, like I say, you're a taxpayer, or you're a school choice voter, or you're a small business owner, and you find that we're running a really active campaign to pick up legislative seats and House seats and whatnot in that area, then you know that you pretty much have to vote Libertarian. That's really the only way to keep the cost of government down. What we haven't been doing is carefully targeting those seats and those districts very precisely. You really have to start about a year before the election. That means that we have to kind of have our boots on the ground and ready to go and be organized by the end of this year, 2019, November, December, to start going around putting up the door hangers and putting together a national version of libertyballot.com. I don't know if you've ever looked at libertyballot.com, but it's kind of a New Hampshire tool we use for our September primary, and we use it again for the general elections and special elections.
Yeah, I'll check that out. I wanted to say that, excuse me, I agree with what you're saying about how, we have a lot to offer, both sides, Democrats and Republicans, but, from what I've seen from, Gary Johnson's message of being fiscally conservative and socially liberal, is that message doesn't really work that well, because what you're doing is as soon as you say the word liberal, you lose all the conservatives. And as soon as you say the word conservative, you lose all the liberals. So instead of being accepted by both, and I'm sure it does work for some, but it seems like it's more you're by saying that you become you become offensive to both instead of accepted.
Well, I think that pretty much every single voter, when you look at independent voters, there's a lot of polling on that, and they're actually more fiscally conservative than Republicans or Democrats. And they're more socially libertarian than Republicans or Democrats.
So yeah, I get that.
When you make a case that way, and then you go to you live in a city where only 15 or 20% of the voters are Republican. Once you go to all those Republican voters and say, well, there are all these younger independent voters who aren't too happy with Trump's right-wing populism, and you have a lot of immigrants and a lot of businesses that depend on immigration, and you have a lot of businesses that depend on activity that some Republican, socially conservative, prohibitionist Republicans would shut down. And so you explain it in those terms. Well, we go to African American and Latino voters, and we're talking about, my bill to end racial profiling, to end overcharging of people of color. Latinos get about 10% more prison time on the first conviction. African Americans get about 15% more prison time on a first conviction. American Indians tend to be can be targeted in some jurisdictions. Those are issues that a smaller number of people care about, but it's their most important issue. Dash cams, body cams for police officers, elected police commissions, putting away prosecutors who are knowingly targeting innocent people. There are lots and lots of issues that Republicans generally don't want to touch, that we really champion: wrongful convictions, evidence preservation, peaceful foreign policy. And when you they they have done polling where they look at independent voters and what are the issues that they care about. And those types of issues, for small numbers of them, you know, climate change is good for 3%. Ending the death penalty, I spoke on the floor in favor of ending the death penalty. About 2% of voters, ending the death penalty is the one issue that they care about. For peaceful foreign policy, it's about 3% of voters. That's all that they care about. That's all they vote on. Civil liberties, about 2 or 3%, and so on. Legalizing marijuana, 3 to 5%, depending on where you are. And in the cities, the Republican brand name has become kind of toxic.
Right.
Because it's changed from Republicanism to conservatism to right wing and now right wing populism, and their national figures have somehow managed to offend just about every small ethnic, religious, gender minority, artist, you know, young person, video gamer. They've somehow managed to offend just about everybody, and so you go to cities where, you know, maybe 20% of people vote Republican. They're being taxed to death. State and local taxes are about twice as high in Democrat-run jurisdictions as they are in Republican jurisdictions. And people want the lower cost. They want the better. They want the roads taken care of. They don't like Democrats micromanaging healthcare, micromanaging schools. They don't like Democrats telling cops how to do their job, interfering with the job that police and business owners and doctors do, and that the Democrat Party has really been taken over by these really controlling busybodies who literally just micromanage everything to death. I mean, they're up there in the state house trying to ban everything from plastic straws to big gulps to handguns to, you know, everything that they don't approve of. And they're regulating everything to death and taxing everything to death. They're taxing canoes and vaping and increasing every tax they can imagine, and pushing Common Core and high-stakes testing and Obamacare and all these other things down on people. And people are feeling the hurt from that. But again, the Republican brand name has become toxic in the cities.
Right. So it's kind of like you're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
So what do people do is, in the cities, you get voter turnout as low as 20%, and there's no way to change things. And we keep hearing from taxpayers, business owners, and even Republicans living in the cities, they keep saying that what they really need is if it's going to be a political party, it's got to be a political party that's not left or right, that's not ideological, but it's just sticking to school choice, business-friendly policies, smaller government, lower taxes, keeping the cost of city government down.
Right. Interesting. So I want to get to this because I know you have another big announcement recently. Do you want to talk about that?
What is that?
Is that are you running for president?
Yeah. I thought that was implied or something. Well, I made my formal announcement on Saturday at a taxpayers picnic.
Nice.
And I spoke to them about tactical voting from the vantage point of taxpayers and small business owners at the taxpayers picnics. You have all these college towns and socially liberal areas and younger areas and cities, and you have cultures that don't jive well with the Republican Party's sometimes hyper-religious messaging and lack of concern for certain issues that younger people tend to care about. And I spoke about that, and you know, probably 2/3 to 3/4 of the people there got it, and they were really enthusiastic about that idea, where they would view the Libertarian Party as a backup party. If they can't get a Republican elected, well, then they'll work to get the Libertarian elected in the same place instead of just giving up and have it turn into a political black hole, at least have it be a little bit competitive. But I'm not sure I like the idea of being a backup party. I think that a bonus party is probably a better way. I think that we're a lot better. We have a lot more to offer conservative voters than the Republican Party does. But yeah, I announced officially on Saturday. I've submitted the paperwork to the FEC. I've finished with my exploratory committee, and people are saying absolutely go in there and campaign and go run your little heart out.
Awesome. So now you got elected as a Republican to your current position. You're going to run as a Libertarian for president?
Right. Well, I contacted the House Clerk's office and asked them to change my party registration with the state to Libertarian. And there's that problem that now that we, our gubernatorial candidate didn't get the 4% needed, so we're bumped down from being considered a political party. Now we're just considered a political organization, similar to a political action committee. So the best I could do for now was just register on my website and just put it in the miscellaneous that I'm a member of the Libertarian Party. But I was able to get the Wikipedia page updated to say we now have one libertarian legislator in the country now.
Awesome. Okay. So that makes sense why that's a big deal now, because before last week that would have said Republican, right?
Right. I'm going to try and get the people who manage the web page to make it clear that this is a libertarian legislator. Obviously, no other minor parties are able to do that. We have strange ballot access laws, and we have strange rules on. There's no such thing as a minor party. You're either a party or you're not in New Hampshire. And that's been a problem. But at least as a legislator, I can put in a bill this September to try to change that so that there's the notion of a minor party by nominating convention. And we're working with the Secretary of State and members of the House Election Law Committee to come up with something that's a little more cost effective and a little more reasonable for candidates to develop a minor party and put their candidates on the ballot.
Right. Yeah. And I can see, you know, I get the idea that, you know, they don't want to print ballots with 10,000 names on it. But at the same time, it is definitely too restrictive. I mean, an organization as big as the Libertarian Party shouldn't have any problem getting on the ballot. Even something like the Green Party shouldn't have any challenges, or the Constitutional Party. Like, they're not huge. But, you know, if we're talking 5 or 10 names, that's not, that shouldn't really be an issue. You shouldn't, you know, that's kind of the thing. We should have more options like that. Otherwise, it's not really a democracy. It's just, you're voting for the wealthiest groups and that's it. And those people are never going to work in your interest for the most part.
And that's one of the amazing things in other countries, that it's almost a given. That it's almost accepted that minor parties have the right to get on the ballot. And in Britain, you'll show up and there can be 5 or 10 parties on your ballot. Now, the really active minor parties go around and do this thing where they put the door hangers on the doors and say, you know, this is a Lib Lab district, or this is a Green Lab district, or this is a UKIP versus Conservative. So if you want to keep the Conservatives out, you've got to vote for UKIP. A lot of people, especially working class voters, will vote for UKIP just to keep the Tories out, cost them a seat. So there's a lot of tactical voting. People are kind of used to that in other countries. And the problem is, the only way to reach all libertarians everywhere in the country, whether they're activists, donors, or candidates, or what have you, they have to understand how tactical voting works. Everyone has to understand it. And the only person in an entire political party or presidential campaign or Senate campaign or what have you, the only person in the entire party apparatus that can reach the maximum number of libertarians out there is the presidential candidate. And so what I'm focusing on in my presidential campaign and going around to tours and stops and speaking with people and doing these types of online interviews is explaining why we need to use tactical voting, how tactical voting or strategic voting works, how it works in other countries, and getting that information out to the rest of the Libertarian Party so that we can hit the ground by the end of the year, knowing what are the 40 to 60 entrenched Republican districts and what are the 40 to 60 entrenched Democrat districts, where we can hit the ground now, start raising money now, and have a chance of picking up a few House seats in Congress in 2020.
Awesome. That sounds great. I mean, you know, that is really what we need to do. I know a lot of at least a lot of the announced candidates at this point are more focusing on, you know, the message instead of the strategy. But I think, you know, like you said, strategy, I'm completely there with you. I
focus a lot on this way. It's 14 entrenched Democrat states and 20 entrenched Republican states. The outsider voters you know, the Democrats living in Republican states and the Republicans living in Democrat states, it's about 28% of the vote. It's about 28% of voters. And then we focus a lot on people, we do well among people who usually just don't even bother voting at all. So if you go to the one in two voters, people who are registered to vote, but they very rarely do vote, they're the most likely, especially the younger voters, are most likely to vote for us. And then also targeting, for example, Republicans who live in the cities and Democrats who live in Rocky Mountain states or rural areas, where they're getting increasingly concerned that the Democrat Party is just pushing socialism and nationalizing things and government taking over schools and healthcare and literally Soviet-style urban planning and gun control and political correctness and a lot of things that just kind of rub people the wrong way. I think that being able to kind of show up at their door and say, well, if you want to cost the Republican a seat here, you've got to vote Libertarian. And in some other area, if you want to cost the Democrats a seat and try to keep your taxes down and get school choice, you've got to vote Libertarian. And I think when people see that as, here's a Lib Dem district, okay, that completely changes the dynamics. We're avoiding the swing voting districts, and we're just focusing on Lib Dem races and Libertarian versus Republican races. And then it makes it much simpler. More to the point, you get a bunch of signs up in people's front yards, and you see a whole bunch of Libertarian signs around you, some for legislature, some for House of Representatives, and a few presidential signs. And you see a couple of billboards up, and it's all concentrated in a few areas. People see the snowball kind of picking up and people talking about it and going to the political events and town hall meetings. By just concentrating just on those areas, you see the polling numbers shoot up. About 70% of Americans live in either the 14 safe blue wall states or the 20 safe Republican states. And about 70 to 75% of voters live in some of those entrenched House districts. So almost everyone, somewhere on your ballot, you've got these entrenched one-party districts, and the only way to break that up is to have a centrist party that, you know, liberals tend to be more Libertarian on social issues and foreign policy issues. Conservatives tend to be more Libertarian on economic issues. So to bring the troops home, end the war on drugs, end the war on crime, get government out of your life, get government out of healthcare, get government out of your town, get government out of your schools. That message resonates with a lot of people everywhere. And the idea of getting back to constitutionally limited government. I think I saw a poll somewhere, even half of Democratic voters would cut middle class taxes. About two thirds want term limits. About two thirds want a balanced budget amendment. And these are even Democratic voters. The vast majority of Republicans and Democrats, but also especially independent voters, definitely want to see things kind of broken up, changed. They want to see things cleaned up in Washington, D.C. They don't want to continue to see politics as usual. And supporting things like term limits and bringing the troops home and some of our kind of core issues, campaigning on that, has been successful so far in legislative campaigns. I think it could be translated into kind of one big presidential campaign, and then that presidential campaign focusing on helping our House candidates and our legislative candidates.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think, you know, that is a great strategy, especially when, you know, Even with people who I think are, you know, yeah, I'm going to vote for Trump just because I don't, it's not a Trump vote, it's an anti-Hillary vote. Those right. people still might vote for a Libertarian for a House seat or a Senate seat, or even a local seat like a mayor or, you know, so I think, you know, still reaching out to those people is, you know, and helping, you know, working with I hate that word down ballot. It makes them sound like they're smaller, but you know, it's with the other, with, you know, working with other positions and other candidates, I think that's, you know, a really, really a great strategy that we all kind of need to work on.
Well, you know, if you are a big time Trump supporter and you're living in one of those 14 entrenched Democrat states, you actually have a better chance of trying to get Trump into the White House by voting Libertarian if you live in one of those 14 states, because the Trump campaign won't even show up. And I think when Republicans and Trump supporters and conservatives and taxpayers groups realize that, you know, just by us campaigning in these otherwise lost states, we're really helping to boost get out the vote efforts, getting a lot of young people out to vote Libertarian, bringing people out to the polls, and that'll help kind of produce mixed Republican, Libertarian, Democrat legislatures, and we'll kind of finally start to get spending and tax rates down.
Awesome. So I want to ask, so now that you're running, we're doing the We Are Libertarian debates on the We Are Libertarian Facebook page and podcast. I think we've got like two or three left. Are you going to be joining us on those? I think the first one or the next one is tomorrow night.
The next one is tomorrow night. And I believe it's on environmental issues, which is for libertarians is actually probably the hardest issue because it's it's viewed very differently by different people. Air pollution and water pollution, I think, are not that difficult. But climate change is really difficult because no one really knows for certain how much human activity is affecting climate change. No one can really predict what
right.
the
Who's at
weather
fault?
Events are going to be 10 years from now. And we're now up to 400 parts per million CO2. And we really don't know what impact that's having, or the solar cycle, or any number of other things. But the more local issues and the simpler issues like land management and air pollution and water pollution, I think we can tackle pretty easily.
So will I see you there tomorrow?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
That's also a webcam event, isn't it?
Yes. And we also have, there's a Massachusetts convention. A lot of the candidates are going to be there this weekend. I know that's kind of not too far from you. Are you planning on showing up for that?
Yeah, that's a 45-minute drive. So those are the two easy ones. The next ones are going to be, you know, the South Carolina debate in September is going to be a tough one, just even to get accepted to that. You know, those of us who are late announcers don't really have as much time to raise money and get all the volunteers together. But I think that if enough people see that there's enthusiasm in, at a minimum, unless Justin Amash announces, which I guess it seems a lot less likely that he's going to. It sounds right. like he's just going to run for re-election as an independent. We're going to have to kind of pull amongst ourselves to kind of pull the Libertarian Party together and go into November with, you know, a real strong set of candidates. I was hoping for Larry Sharp, but I understand that he's very busy with his family and business and his career right now.
Right.
But there are a lot of really good candidates for both president and vice president. But I think we have to spend the next 6 months or so just focusing on what's going to be our strategy for 2020 and working on down ticket U.S. House races and legislative races.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, having talked to you now for a while and, you know, hearing a lot of your ideas and you know, your beliefs and your knowledge and your strategies and everything, I'm actually really interested in your campaign. So I would actually support you to make sure that you're included in a lot of these debates. That's how us libertarians roll. We kind of support each other. You know, it's not like the Democrats where they'd be like, okay, let me do whatever I can do to get this guy out because he's a threat to me. You know, I think it's really important that we all have, you know, these really great different perspectives, different strategies. We all have different ways of looking at information and presenting it and, you know, who we're going to, you know, what audiences we're going to connect with the most. And I think that really kind of supports the whole message. So, you know, if you, you know, I'm happy to invite you along and I'd really like to see you in, you know, in as many of debates that we have coming up.
I'd love to be there. I think that and I have got to agree with you. I think that we're at our best when we've at least got four or five candidates on stage, that it looks terrific when you're hearing different kinds of libertarianism. I message well to non-libertarians. I know I haven't done as well in the past reaching, you know, libertarians within the party. There's a lot of dispute between the non-aggression principle and the harm principle folks. And, you know, those of us who favor constitutionally limited government like me and those who want to just kind of, you know, theoretically have a stateless society, you know, and I think when people hear libertarianism from different angles, left libertarian, right libertarian, and all the different colors in the rainbow, that people get a different image of it and get a better idea that it's just, you know, getting money, power, and decision making back down to the local level and back to the people. And, you know, people have the right to live their lives as they see fit, so long as they're not harming anyone else. And I think those two basic ideas, once people get their head around it, government should be as small and as decentralized as possible, and people have a right to kind of live and let live. Once people get their head around that, I think that they come around and realize that they're mostly libertarian.
Right. And I really like that too. And that's been a big focus of my campaign, is just that, you know, we like, I don't like preaching to the choir. I could talk to libertarians all day and they'd be like, oh yeah, yeah, we get it. We like you. You're a libertarian. But what does that do for us in the big picture? We need to be out talking to people who are typically voting Republican and Democrat, and helping them to realize, hey, you know, voting big government is how we got here. We have to figure out a way to get away from that. And you know, I know that's not going to help you get the nomination, because now you're not pandering to all of the, all of the delegates. But at the same time, but this is what we need to do. This is how we need to spend this time. Cause if we wait until someone gets the nomination and then at that point we decide to start figuring out how to talk to non-libertarians, then it's like, we wasted all this time. And we're starting from ground zero, and it's not effective. You're going to get the libertarian vote and that's about it. And maybe a little bit more, but you know, that doesn't help. It's not the best strategy.
Well, remember that, Trump and Clinton's campaign raised and spent, close to $4 billion, nearly all of it on those 16 battleground states. And that's based on them, 98% chance of winning. Ron Paul, when he ran for the Republican nomination, only had, when he started, about a 1 or maybe 2% chance of winning. Of course, he didn't win, unfortunately, came in third and second or third in most states. He did come in first in a few states. Then Fox News, of course, didn't report that. The mainstream media didn't report Ron Paul. If he came in third, they reported the top two. If he came in second, they reported whoever the winner was. And if he came in first, they ignored the primary straw poll outright. And we saw that happen again and again and again, and people were fuming. But just having a 1 or 2% chance of winning, he raised about $41 million. And with Gary Johnson and Weld, they were at 31% among independent voters by September of 2016, and they were able to raise, I guess, $13 or $14 million. And outside of the presidential, we raise, $15 or $16 million. Each election cycle. Well, that might not sound like much, but it's enough to launch 15 House races every election cycle, to win 15 House races, to launch them. Once you've launched those campaigns and they have offices open and you're working to get people, we're working as a team, we're helping the legislative campaigns beneath that, and those legislative campaigns are working to help the whole party. Then you tend to get a lot of straight ticket voting, and then you start winning state senators, county council members. You start getting people elected to sheriff. You start getting more people elected down ticket. And that's kind of the groundswell of support that starts bringing people up. And you've just got to have one very strong candidate who can message to every potential libertarian voter out there, however, whatever reason they might have, want to bring the troops home and the war on drugs, just downsize government. Their taxes are too high. They want to protect their property rights and their Second Amendment rights and their due process rights from what the two parties are doing. And it gives people a strong reason to show up and vote, not only to vote, but to vote libertarian when they realize that it's going to have an impact, that will, when we run as a team, we can get everyone up into double digits and get everyone up into double digits. You start seeing legislative candidates, winning, and once they're winning the legislative seats, we come back in 2022 and 2024 and capitalize on that and raise 10 times as much money because we're winning elections instead of just being educational campaigns.
Absolutely. So I have one more question for you. You talk about how, the media kind of screwed over Ron Paul. I know they did the same kind of thing with Gary Johnson in some cases. Who else? They've done the same to other people.
They did that to me when I was running for governor, and I still managed to break records. I won 31,234 votes. I won more votes in New Hampshire than the Johnson Weld ticket. And Governor Weld was right down there in Massachusetts. He's very well known in New Hampshire. And I had I I don't mean to boast, but I do have pretty good name recognition in New England myself, especially New Hampshire. Awesome. There was a poll out that said I was at 28% name recognition at the start of my legislative term, and I think I'm probably over 40% now.
So, do you have any special strategies? And of course, you don't have to share them with me now that we're competing. Do you have any special strategies for kind of overcoming this with the media, like where they're, where they're not going to give you airtime, they're not going to interview you, they're not going to print articles, this sort of thing, especially now that you've announced that you're running as a libertarian and no longer a Republican?
Go ahead with full knowledge that you're not going to be able to rely on the mainstream media. What we have is social media. We have left outreach. We have right outreach. We have letters to the editor. We have independent media. I took advantage of both conservative talk radio, libertarian talk radio, and all the different groups, the one issue groups, whatever it might be, where I had any agreement with them, and I reached out to them, and they were telling their members, hey, you've got to vote for Max Abramson because he's the one guy in the gubernatorial race who's got our issue. And, you know, a few hundred votes here, a few hundred votes there, eventually it started to add up. Not just having a campaign website that you're updating a couple of times a week. You know, just my unadvertised website right now gets, 500 or 600 or 700 unique views a week. And those people who get involved and pay attention, they do vote libertarian. I think that Harry Brown said that of the people who heard their message, something like 50 or 55% voted libertarian. And unfortunately, the Harry Brown campaign didn't run as many TV ads as they should with the money that they had. And then Michael Bednarik in 2004 only raised about $350,000 because they didn't have a large network or base to draw. But again, as soon as you show a road to the White House, which only the Libertarian Party can do, because we're the only ones who get 50 state ballot access, and we're the only ones who can now take advantage of tactical voting, getting Republicans who live in entrenched Democrat areas and getting Democrats former Reform Party members and Veterans Party members who live in entrenched Democrat areas, people who are not happy with the two-party system and aren't happy with having one party run their city hall, their state legislature, holding the governor's mansion every single year, year after year. The only way to break that up is to support a political party that's a mix of two, you know, a mix of the two philosophies and has a broad outreach and has a broad range. And that's pretty well known now, especially with after the campaign of Johnson and Weld. I think that a lot of people take our effort more seriously than they would have without that campaign.
Right. Awesome. Well, this has been a really great talk, and I look forward to seeing you tomorrow and this weekend. And if you have anything you want to plug, if you want to give out your website, any of your social media pages, anywhere anyone can check you out, make a donation, volunteer.
Website, if you have Bitcoin, take Bitcoin donations, maxabramson.org. And the Facebook page, my legislative page is Representative Max Abramson. But my presidential campaign Facebook page, just opened it up. It's just Max Abramson 2020.
Awesome. Sounds great. Well, it's been great talking to you again, and maybe we'll have you on again sometime further into the campaign. And until then, we'll see you next time in Taxation is Theft.
Hope to see you then.
Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as bad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.